In February, KCUR launched a project called Beyond Our Borders. We wanted to investigate whether Kansas City is divided between rich and poor, black and white, urban and suburban, or if our communities transcend difference in some way. To kick off the project, we asked you to identify the major geographic dividing lines in and around Kansas City. And when your answers came in, one street was mentioned again and again: Troost Avenue. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll wrap up our focus on this border with a conversation about what we mean when we say Troost. When people talk about Troost, is that code for race? Stay tuned for that conversation after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we're wrapping up KCUR's investigation of Troost as a dividing line in Kansas City. Today's conversation centers around a simple question. When we talk about Troost, are we talking about race? Troost is just a street, but when we say Troost, or even east of Troost, those words and phrases carry decades of meaning, and they signify much more than location. So what does Troost mean? And is it time for that meaning to change? Before we dive in, let's listen back to some of KCUR's reporting from east of Troost over the past few months. Here's community engagement reporter Laura Ziegler.
At Wild Woody's Happy Foods, 31st and Myrtle, we ran into former city councilwoman Mary Williams-Neal.
And I love living in this community. I came here to get my hog maws and my collard greens today. I love the idea that I have a store here. I try my very best to support the store. I wish that the store appearance would change. When I enter the store, it looks a bit jail-looking.
West on 31st Street at Troost, we stopped in at Operation Breakthrough, the largest daycare and social service agency in the area. There we met Jeremy. He'd grown up in the 20th and Van Brunt area. He went to private school until his mother couldn't afford it anymore. And while he was there, he went to Rockhurst High School. He relished the academics and made friends, which wasn't always easy.
You go over to their house after school, she'd pick you up, got bagels in the car with this type of snack and that type of snack, going home making this and that. The kid has his own bathroom. We got a little two-bedroom house. There's no gas in the house. The freaking toilet bowl busted because it's so cold in the house. Freezing cold showers. Totally embarrassed to bring anybody. Nobody I ever went to school with ever went to my house.
After graduation, Jeremy was lured into the fast money of crime and street life and landed in jail. Today, he's working and trying to raise his children in a family home not far from where he grew up. We explored the culture of violence. Our Peggy Lowe attended a community meeting at the Lucille H. Bluford Library on 30th and Prospect. There, a panel of teens were talking about losing a sibling to homicide.
In 2008,
part of the conversation focused on the need for professional counseling and trying to help these young people. Heather Fitzcharles Keller said a professional therapist notices things in kids adults aren't trained to recognize.
We may be looking for normal, quote-unquote, sadness kind of thing, tears and that kind of thing, and you don't see that in children. They tend to express it more as anger, maybe acting out or withdrawing.
We heard about some of the beautiful things along Troost, like the drifts of tulips that still bloom each spring at Rockhurst University and green spaces here and there. Alicia Sparks, the director of community relations, says in spite of the dwindling number of places planting tulips today, the program still promotes conversation about Troost as a racial divide.
I still believe that the main idea of Tulips on Troost is to get people to change their attitudes about the perception and to change the conversation about color.
The idea of the Belger Crane Yard and Red Star Ceramic Studios at 2011 Tracy is, in part, an effort to nudge the arts across Troost from the crossroads. It's in a lovely, renovated 19th-century industrial building, once home to a wax paper company and tension envelope. Manager Michael Baxley says it's an extension of the Belger Art Center at 2100 Walnut.
More recently, they've been interested in expanding the arts and opening the second location, which is an art center, which encompasses more than just ceramics. We have printmaking and metal and sculpture.
KCUR's Laura Spencer found urban planners involved in efforts to convert the many vacant lots in the area to some kind of green space. Sean Partain, at the time a student in the design department at UMKC, talked about the connections between ecology and urban planning.
We often use terms that are derived from ecology and botany, like blight. It's, you know, a disease that it infests plants, and we use it to describe the urban realm.
In the historic Northeast, the Indian Mound, Skerritt, Independence Plaza, and Pendleton Heights neighborhoods are grappling with how to address the impact of homeless camps along Cliff Drive. Brent Schaffner is spearheading efforts to clean up parks in the area.
We're angry because these people aren't getting help. I mean, I don't want to sound horrible, but we have to continue to deal with these people, and we're not trained professionals. We're people that care about the neighborhood. I care about this park, and this stuff like just perpetuates the negativity and the thought that the entire Northeast is an unsafe place when it's really not.
Laura Ziegler and KCUR's community engagement team brought us that montage of stories from the Beyond Our Borders project, which has so far focused on Troost Avenue. Something that we've wrestled with in our reporting is the often unspoken relationship between Troost and race. And then there's the challenge of separating perception from reality. When we say east of Troost, how far east do we mean? Do suburbs like Lee's Summit count as east of Troost? And if not, why not? So today, we're laying these questions bare. Let's start by talking with Tricia Bushnell. She's the legal director for the Midwest Innocence Project. Hi, Tricia.
Hi, good morning.
We invited Tricia here today not because of her job title, but because of something she told The Pitch when she was interviewed for their weekly questionnaire. She was asked to complete a sentence beginning with, "Kansas City got it wrong when..." So, Tricia, I'd like you to share your complete sentence on the air for our listeners.
Sure. It's, "Kansas City got it wrong when it became acceptable to use east of Troost as a euphemism for race."
And you went on to say the following: the terminology doesn't fool anyone, and it doesn't change the fact that the folks who live there are just people like me and everyone else. The difference is that no one is using geographic terms to gloss over and forget me. What did you mean by that? Could you elaborate?
Yeah, well, so the background behind this is I'm still a fairly new resident to Kansas City. I moved here about 6 months ago in December. And when I was moving, I was trying really hard to find that neighborhood where I wanted to live, and everyone was telling me where they thought I should live. And unilaterally, I was told, do not go east of Troost. And so then I started looking online, and there's all these forums you can look at when you're moving, and these websites, things like City Data. And people would overtly state not only do not move east of Troost, but put some really awful racial slurs and terms behind it. And it became clear to me then when I moved here and I actually went east of Troost that this is what we were talking about. You know, there is no difference between living on one side or the other than we don't invest as much on the side of east of Troost as we do anywhere else.
Where did you move here from again?
I moved here from Madison, Wisconsin.
Were you aware of any similar problems there, or do you think there's something particular about Kansas City's issues with this?
There definitely is a problem in Madison. I think there's recent studies that came out that say it is now, quite frankly, one of the worst places to be born an African-American child. But the way that we talk about it is slightly different. There they might say South Madison, which is historically a very diverse area for a lot of different racial divides groups. But here, you know, when I started investigating and learning more about Troost, and I learned about the history when we had Jim Crow's laws on east of Troost, it's even more startling. You know, we talk a little bit in the Midwest, I work for the Midwest Innocence Project, so we consider Kansas City the Midwest.
And what is the Midwest Innocence Project?
We're an organization that we work in five different states. We represent individuals who are convicted of crimes they say they didn't commit, and then we go and prove that they didn't commit them and attempt to get their release. So, you know, working in there, we call this the Midwest. Prior to living in Madison, I lived in Alabama, so I've also lived in what is very much considered the South. And I think the identity here in Kansas City, and when we talk about things or work about things, we have some of that influence of the Midwest, we have some of that influence of the South, and we have that history that goes with it, where when we have a geographical location, it becomes acceptable to use it as a term historically over time. And in fact, if we're going to do make law analogies, these are the types of euphemisms that prosecutors have made around the country throughout history when they go to racially discriminate against a juror.
What do you mean by that? Can you explain what you mean?
Sure. So in the jury setting, each side will get what are called peremptory strikes, where they can just say, this juror, I don't want that one, and they don't have to give a reason. If it looks like they're using race as a reason to strike the jurors, then the defendant can challenge that, because actually it's the juror's right. The juror has a right to sit on that jury, and the only person who can challenge it is the is either party, because that juror won't know they're being discriminated against. So when they do that and they make that challenge, because say, for example, all the black jurors have been struck, the prosecutor has to give reasons why they struck them. And there was a time, particularly in Alabama, when they would give these geographic terms, and they might say, well, they live in that area, and I don't want jurors from that area. And, you know, we were able to, particularly in Alabama, use those language to overcome that and win those challenges on the what's called the Batson grounds.
So when people use the word truced metaphorically, or in any way other than to refer to a physical street, is it your feeling that they're being racist in kind of an under-the-radar way?
You know, I don't know that folks are being overtly racist. I don't think that individuals live in a vacuum. We're all part of this social sphere and this social network. And when we think historically, yes, truced has been a racial term. And that becomes part of our social language. And so when we say it, I think a lot of folks aren't thinking about it. That doesn't mean it isn't what it is. But people maybe don't have a maliciousness behind it when they say it.
If you look at a U.S. census map, as much as I want this not to be the case, there's still a pretty sobering division along racial lines when it comes to who lives on either side of that street. And that's most pronounced the closer you get to Troost, less so as you get even blocks away. Do you think the way we talk about Troost plays a role in that?
I'm sure that can be. But also the way that we talk about Troost plays a role in how we invest in it, how we work for it. If we think of an area constantly through our language as being this specialized area, regardless of which way it is, maybe we think it's, you know, Silicon Valley, a place that we invest in a lot in, that plays a role in it. And so people are either going to be stuck where they are for socioeconomic reasons, or they're never going to get that benefit out or to become a better place that we can make that.
I know you're not a linguist or a race expert. You're a lawyer. But as someone new to our city who can hear our conversations with fresh ears, what do you think would be a productive, honest, sensitive way to talk about these things? Because not talking about them also feels like a cop-out.
You know, I think the conversation that's beginning today is that conversation. You know, I did just move here, but I very much consider myself now part of this community. And it's just as much my responsibility to challenge people when they say East of Truth. Well, what do you mean by that? And when people say that to me, I ask them specifically, what do you mean by that? And they might talk about crime rates and they might talk about trash. I hear a lot of comments about litter. But you have to ask, well, why is it that way? What are we doing about that? And really asking people on a one-on-one level, because, you know, in the end, the only way we can change our social thought is on the one-on-one, you know, speaking to each other's hearts and minds.
Tricia Bushnell of the Midwest Innocence Project, thanks so much for stopping by our studios today.
Thank you.
Tricia was invited to join us when we read her answer to a pitch questionnaire prompt. She said that Kansas City got it wrong when it became acceptable to use East of Troost as a euphemism for race. We want to know what you think. When we talk about Troost, are we talking about race? And if so, is that useful or constructive? Call us at 816-235-2888 to join the discussion. That's 816-235-2888. Here in the studio, we have a panel of guests, so let's get to know them. Rodney Knott is with us from Reengage, a program at Troost Reconciliation Services. Hi, Rodney.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Thanks for being here. First of all, tell us, what is Reengage?
Reengage is a men's training program that I developed in conjunction with a group of educators from UMKC. The mission of Reengage is to transform males into men through training, support, and empowerment. And so by trade, I was a computer network engineer, but I began to notice that there was a need in our community. And that need was that there were a number of males who didn't know how to be men. And so one of the things that I began to look at is how can we make that transformation possible? And that's sort of what led to the creation of Reengage.
What is your relationship with Troost?
Well, besides our training in offices being on 31st and Troost, I am originally from Kansas City, and so I've got a long history of Troost. I remember Troost when it was much different than it is today. But I also remember the transformation taking place.
Will you share a little bit of more about those memories with us?
Well, when I was younger, Troost used to be a very vibrant economic district. Folks that didn't want to go downtown could go to Troost. There were a number of department stores. There were sole proprietorships. You could find shoes, clothes, bakeries, pretty much a lot of what you have in Brookside. You had along Troost, but only in more abundance. There were movie theaters. There was a number of businesses along Troost.
What is the change that you remember happening? Was it quick? Was it dramatic?
No. Changes like this are always gradual. And I think that's the, unfortunately, that's the what makes it so bad is that it occurs so gradually that folks tend to not notice it. And so basically as integration occurred and more blacks were able to move out of the district they were in, then the transformation began to take place.
What do you think about the way we talk about Troost as a city?
Well, I think it. If you look at Troost, it's quite easy to pronounce it as it's about race. And that's a part of it, because Kansas City, a lot of people aren't really aware of the history. There was segregation all over the country, but there were certain areas, as my mentor, Father David, used to say, suffered from hyper-segregation. Kansas City was one of those cities, whereas a lot of cities during the 70s, late 60s began to address their racial issues. We never had those conversations in Kansas City. And so it was just allowed to continue to go unabated.
Well, do you think it's time to have a new kind of conversation, either about Troost or about race or about the two together? Or is the conversation we've been having the conversation that needs to continue?
No. The conversation we've been having obviously has failed. But the difficulty in having the conversation is that we have become more polarized, not just in Kansas City, but as a society. Folks tend to listen to those that agree with them. You have folks that turn on cable news shows that will echo their own beliefs. They tend to move around people who echo their own beliefs. And so we've become much more isolated in our beliefs. And so the difficulty is whenever you try to have a conversation around issues like this, people begin to use code words.
Do you think Troost is a code word?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I look at racism in the same terms as terrorism. Once you've been called a racist, that's pretty much the end of the conversation. You're pretty much dismissed. How do you prove that you're not a racist? And so I think that until we're able to have a conversation where there is not that desire to minimize and to categorize and label people, it's never going to be very beneficial. Sort of like in South Africa, they had the truth and reconciliation conversations where people actually could come and share their beliefs without fear of being demonized. And I think here, whenever we try to have that conversation, folks are demonized because there are those, there's some complex, obscure economic formula that shows that poverty can be profited from. And so there's a number of folks who are profiting from keeping Troost the way it is. And so whenever someone comes along to try to change the conversation, they're immediately shouted down and demonized so that we keep it pretty much like it is.
That's really interesting. And I want to get back to this idea that someone might be profiting from things stagnating. I do want to get back to that, but now let's turn to Pete Hughes. He's also here with us this morning. He lives near Troost and is involved in his neighborhood association, but he's here because people in his community recognize him as an informal leader and organizer. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
How would you describe what you do in your neighborhood?
Well, I wouldn't say my role is all that important compared to the role that many other people have played, including Rodney Knott. I agree with my friend Mary Williams Neal, who was quoted a few moments ago on your program here. I love living in this neighborhood. I live right on Troost Avenue. I live there by choice. I've been there for almost 13 years now. And I agree with Rodney that Troost has lots of challenges ahead of it, but I also see some really positive changes taking place. And I'd like to believe that I'm a part of that, but I'm certainly not a major player. There's just so many people. Jackson County Legislator Scott Burnett has he and a couple other people from the St. James Church community have put together a group that's called the Troost Alliance, and they meet once a month, and it's a networking process only. They don't get involved in heavy political issues. They're not involved in sponsoring businesses. It's just an opportunity for people to get together and talk over lunch. And there are somewhere between 30 and 50 people at any given time. And when you sit there and attend that, you realize how much vibrancy and how much interest there is in the area. I think there's a couple of unusual things that are happening. One is that young white people, especially close to, in the neighborhoods close to Troost, are moving back into the area. And for the first time since I've been here, there are black folks that are starting businesses on Troost. And I see those as positive signs. There's a new barbershop in the 3400 block, Diamond Cuts. There's a guy named Phil Diamond that started that business, and it's a very successful barbershop right now. It's been in there for several years, but right across the street, Phil's wife opened Diamond in the Rough, which is a children's clothing store. So there's just a lot of signs. There's a group of young people that have chosen to buy houses in my neighborhood. I think they're in Rodney's neighborhood.
When you say young people, can you explain a little more who you're talking about? Is there a philosophy that they're coming in with, or a certain something that they're looking for in the neighborhood?
Well, I don't think there's a dominant philosophy, really, but they tend to ride bicycles. They don't have cars, most of them. They've started a bike shop called the 816 Bicycle Collective, which is a free bike shop to anybody that wants to come in and work with one of their volunteers to fix their bike. It's been great for the kids in our neighborhood. They've purchased a piece of property. They've rented property for their bike shop up to this point, but they recently purchased a building, and they get their friends and other volunteers to help them remodel this building.
Well, I want to know what you think about the way we talk about Troost as a city.
I think there's no sense in ignoring the history of Troost Avenue, but I think when you live there and you get right, you know, you get down to the day-to-day process of living in the area and working in a neighborhood, my experience is that I tend to forget about the racial differences because the people I'm dealing with are people like Rodney, Mary Williams, Neal, Dee Evans.
Just people.
Yeah, just people. And my own neighborhood, people that I've worked with year after year. And when we have cleanup events, you know, I don't see any racial line that develops there. There's no doubt that race plays a role in Kansas City. But
Does that role have something to do with Troost, or is Troost just a word that becomes part of the conversation?
Well, I think, like I said, there's no sense in ignoring the history. But I think if we, in our day-to-day lives, do either a small part by going to a luncheon to get to know other people or do something major like make an investment in a business on Troost Avenue, it tends to blur those lines, just the process of being involved. People forget that the person across the table from them is black or white.
So it sounds like you're saying it's not a matter of changing a conversation. It's more changing behavior.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. People are what they do, really. That's been my experience in life and on Troost Avenue. You can't use, you know, inflammatory racial terms, but how you live and how you invest your money and spend your time really says it all in terms of what people do and what affects neighborhoods.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I've been talking with Rodney Knott of Truce Reconciliation Services, Pete Hughes, a neighborhood activist. We're talking about Truce, and now I'd like to bring Daniel Serta into the conversation, and I'd like to start getting to your calls pretty soon, too. The number to call to join the conversation is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Daniel Serta is a city planner with Insight. He specializes in the interaction between the structure of cities and the imaginations of their inhabitants. Daniel, you've said that Troost has become a meme. What did you mean by that?
Well, if you think about the idea of a meme, the way we talk about it, with these trends and buzzwords that sort of populate the internet and a lot of our popular discourse, what they are is they're basically a potent way of oversimplifying a complex reality. And I think that's what the phrase East of Truce does. I was, thinking about this in advance of the show, and, Truce as a barrier was probably most potent about 50 years ago, at the height of the civil rights movement. It was when that process of change, when literally doors were being broken open, when that happened, that was when truce became the really hard barrier. And it was not a hard barrier in legal terms. It was a hard barrier in terms of social practices. African Americans finally had choice about where they could live, about where they could locate their business. But they were still, through the processes of, individual decision makers or who owned property or who was brokering property, whatever the case, were steered essentially east of Troost. I thought Trisha's comments were very revealing earlier.
And she's the person from the Midwest Innocence Project who had responded to a pitch questionnaire by saying that Kansas City got it wrong when it became acceptable to use East of Troost as a euphemism for race.
Exactly. And if you think about the history of this, the reality is there was a Jim Crow pattern that happened, right? There was an informal set of practices that conditioned essentially people's ability to make decisions for themselves. What I think is problematic about and what led to my comment about this becoming sort of a meme is that that hard reality has broken down. It's fractured. It's become much more complex. There's blight west of Troost. There are African Americans living west of Troost. And as you noted earlier, Gina, how far east does east go when you say east of Troost? Does it go to Raytown? Does it go to Lee's Summit? The reality is the situation on the ground has changed in ways that are both good and bad. They're both complicated and problematic. But there are people that are living their lives and enjoying their neighbors and having a good time of it. But when we come back to this sort of loaded terminology, what's really interesting is the way you hear that term used. Before I came here last night, I did a quick search of the Kansas City Star's archive for the phrase East of Troost for about the last year and a half. And in 2013, there were about 20 articles in the Kansas City Star that used the phrase East of Troost. Only two of those articles were using that phrase in a purely descriptive way. There was an article talking about a car accident that happened about a block east of Troost. There was another reference to a problem on the trolley track trail, the physical problem with the trail itself that was worst south of, I forget how far south, but east of Troost as well. A fourth of those articles were about social and economic problems. They were about homelessness. They were about blight. They were about violence. They were about food deserts, inequality. Four of those articles were about economic or housing redevelopment projects that are located east of Troost. About four of them were about political issues. There's a coalition east of Troost, that sort of thing. So if you look at the predominant way the phrase is used, it's not used in a descriptive sense. It's used as more of a metaphor, right? And again, metaphors oversimplify reality.
Do we talk the way we talk because of the way things are, or are things the way they are partly because of how we talk about them?
Well, this might not seem like a satisfying answer, but it's both. There's an idea, urban planning is really sort of rooted in urban sociology. And classic urban sociology talks about the social ecology of the city. I heard one of the earlier guests in the earlier parts of the series talk about this, sort of like the use of the word blight. It comes from natural ecology, but we use it to describe how cities function. Well, there's a thread that emerged in urban sociology back during the 1940s and 50s that said, you know, you have this sort of structurally constituted nature of the city, which you can call the social ecology of the city. But layered on top of that is what you might call the symbolic ecology of the city, which is they're the meanings and understandings that emerge from the reality on the ground. And what's really interesting about those, to get to your question, is those meanings and those beliefs in turn shape our decisions and our behaviors as individuals and as institutions, and then in fact both reflect and begin to change that reality.
Central Standard is going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll return to this conversation with Pete Hughes, Rodney Knott, and Daniel Cerda about Troost, and whether when we talk about Troost, we are really talking about race. We'd like to bring you in on that conversation, too. 816-235-2888. We're going to get to you right after this break. Don't go anywhere. Good morning, and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm joined here by Pete Hughes, who's a neighborhood activist. He lives near Troost. Rodney Knott, who comes to us from Troost Reconciliation Services. And Daniel Cerda, a city planner with Insight. We've been talking about what Troost means to the people of Kansas City, and whether when we talk about Troost, we are really talking about race. Daniel Cerda was just talking to us about the idea of Troost having become highly symbolic, and I wonder if our other two guests want to respond to that idea.
Well, first of all, let me correct you in saying I'm from Reengage. I don't actually represent Reconciliation Services.
Okay.
But I did want to comment on Daniel's very insightful comment, in that Troost has become a symbol. And as he shared, the thing about symbols is that they're too simplistic. Is it fair to say that someone is a racist because they don't want to live in an area that has a large population of abandoned homes, that it's in a school system that's not educating the children, that it is has very few services, economic opportunities? I mean, if a person chooses not to live there, does that make them racist? And so if that is in fact true, then so if the black folks that don't live there, are they now racist? I mean, it's just too complicated to try to, again, find this quick symbol or this quick mean, as Daniel stated, to resolve these complicated issues.
And Pete, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I agree with Rodney. I think there are a lot of black people living east of Troost that choose to live there. If they had an opportunity to live elsewhere, they wouldn't. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you kind of go to the various churches in our area of the city, you generally see there's some multiracial churches, but in general, people choose to go to church with their own racial group. That's been my observation. I don't see anything wrong with that. I mean, people should feel free to associate with whoever they want to. I do think that one of the interesting things that happens when people move to a neighborhood east of Troost or near Troost is they, almost without exception, are pleasantly surprised about that it's not a dangerous place generally, that there are not a lot of hostile people around them that want to push them out. I've found Troost Avenue, once you're there, to be a friendly place. And I think the black folks that live around Troost Avenue that choose to live there feel the same way.
Do you think that there can be a value judgment that comes when people talk about what race of people predominantly lives in an area?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you spoke of census data earlier, and you talked about the census tract for race. But it's also for economics, okay? And so the thing that we have to look at is why are businesses not willing to do business there? And so one of the things that I discuss in the conversations that I have in my training and with people I speak to is that we have got to learn certain principles that we use. In other words, recirculation of currency is one of those principles. In other words, prior to integration, there was 18th and Vine. And 18th and Vine was a very vibrant black business district. because the blacks had to have services, and since they were segregated, they had to have them in-house. And so what that created was it created a lot of very wealthy black folks because they were providing services to other black folks. And so the thing of it is that they were recirculating currency within that community. That builds economic development. This idea that some government or some super private foundation is going to come east of Truce and fix it is not rooted in any reality. The redevelopment of Truce must occur from the folks living east of Truce.
Let's hear from our callers on this. We have so much to unpack here, and I want to get our listeners involved in the conversation. Let's turn to Henry in Overland Park. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Dina. Thank you for this program. For 31 years, I had a law office one door east of Truce on 47th Street, and my relationship with my clients was a very individual one. Didn't make any difference whether what race they were. I would like to point out that the city should foster urban business homesteading on Truce. When we look back at history, H&R Block and Walt Disney got their start on Truce. Yes, we have the UMKC Incubator Center there, but I think that the city should be building some, maybe smaller office buildings or something.
Hey, Henry,
to foster persons.
You mentioned a term, urban business homesteading. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, in the early days when Kansas was founded, people, could get a plot of land, 60 or acres or whatever, to start a business, start their farm. And I think that to provide jobs for people in that particular area, I helped start a business association in 1981 or 82, which went for several years. And I tried to contact the Walmarts and the Pennies and others to come in there and put some kind of facility on Truce. It's very hard to compete against, a Main Street or further out south. But I think that it would be a wise investment for persons that want to start a small business. Like people have a starter home, and so it's more of an inexpensive place. So I think, that would be a great benefit. A few persons were reluctant to come to my office at 47th and Truce because I also have a Kansas office. But and people would ask me, are you a victim of crime and whatever? And I left my front door unlocked, and I could see who was coming and going or whatever. But it was a very diverse community, and fortunately you've got, UMKC and Rockhurst as anchors there. It'd be nice if there were some other businesses, though, to employ and provide incomes for people.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Henry.
You're welcome.
And, Henry did mention that when he had a law office there just right east of Truce, that some of his clients were reluctant to visit him there. They preferred to visit his Kansas office. Is that something that those of you who do live and work near Truce encounter, that people are afraid?
Yeah, I this is Pete speaking here. I have experienced that. I manage a couple of properties in the area, and I've found that occasionally when you call a subcontractor, they're hesitant to come to the area. But once I reassure them that I live in the 3300 block and my experience has been good, I think most of the time once they come and park their van and come to do their work, I think things change. So I think as people engage with the street, and there are a lot of people that live, for instance, north of the river that almost never come down to this part of the city. So I think a lot of it is just based on lack of experience and lack of information.
What do you think of – go on, Daniel.
Well, Gina, one of the things I think is important to note is that it's not just individuals choosing not to patronize businesses there or being worried about it. One of the larger issues with urban economic development is that large businesses are afraid to invest in areas like this. There's a perception that there's too much risk, that there's too much crime, that the overall demographics, the median household income is just too low. The reality of most urban urban neighborhoods is everybody needs a place to live. Everybody needs a place to sleep. Everybody needs food to eat. And, you know, even in areas that are, you know, relatively not very affluent, there tends to be, especially in denser urban areas, a fair amount of purchasing power there. If there are not venues in which folks can reinvest those dollars, so to speak, to use Rodney's terminology, they're going to have to go somewhere else. And they do.
But do you think it is all about economics, or since our conversation is about race, do you think race figures into that conversation?
I think one of the important things to know here is that economic issues are at the core of a lot of what we're talking about. And to the extent we have a conscious conversation about this issue, it's usually about the racial dimension and not the economic piece.
So we should talk more about economics.
Absolutely.
You know, I think that one of the things that I've observed since the Home Depot Costco project has opened on Linwood. Well, first of all, let me say that I know Councilman Jim Glover, and he spent a number of years pulling that project together, along with other people, of course. But I think both Home Depot and Costco had some reservations because their demographic studies were saying, well, the money's not there. But once they opened those stores, and by the way, I know that Costco is very successful and Home Depot is also. And I think I'm certainly glad it's there, and I think they're glad that they have that presence there.
Well, let's hear from another caller. We've got Molly in Kansas City on the line.
Hi. I recently graduated from UMKC as part of their Urban Studies program, and we worked a lot on Troost. And I can attest to what everyone else is saying that, you know, it is a great environment and there are friendly people. And the mentality to bring it back is there. And just referring to it that way as if it were something of the past is sort of the problem. That we need to focus on all of the good that's there now. And when you talk to many people in other parts of the city, you know, they often find that they're shocked that you're just on Troost, you know, doing a neighborhood study or something.
That you would so much as set foot there?
Yeah, like they're just aghast that as, you know, a young student, you would be there. It's just, you know, it's very eye-opening to see other people's attitudes towards it when, you know, I can walk around and say I've met incredible people and I love working on Troost. And I, you know, I've done internships with different neighborhood places and I just, it's a great environment, and
Molly,
to refer to it as something less than is sad to me.
I want to jump in here and ask you, you've talked about what you think isn't working about the conversation about Troost. How would you envision a better conversation about Troost?
Well, I really liked how they talked about, you know, the young people in the neighborhoods that are coming back, and just the positives, that there are new businesses opening up, that, you know, just the sort of neighborhood activities are really a positive way to look at it.
Thanks, Molly.
Thank you.
And we want to get to another caller really quickly. Let's talk to Josh in Topeka. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
The point I wanted to make was just that one of your guests stated that, you know, the idea that whether it was government or private industry coming in and changing the situation is a valid point, but I think it misses the totality of the conversation. The situation on Troost and east of Troost, Troost is a dividing line, did not occur without decades and decades of institutionally supported segregation and racism. And the government, our local government, is the community writ large. That's your opportunity to engage the elected leadership and leverage those resources, because neighborhoods don't change without support and infrastructure and services. I lived on Troost, off of Troost, 39th and Troost, for a number of years. The fact of the matter was, at the time, and this is 20 years removed, there was prostitution, there was drug activity, there was violence. Great neighbors. We were in Hyde Park, wonderful people. Without that kind of institutional support, you cannot undo or reverse what was institutionally desired and supported for a number of decades.
I want to get one of our guests in on this. Go ahead, Rodney.
Well, listening to the caller, I agree that it has been institutionally, historically done. However, this idea that we're going to repair it through the same means that it was done is unrealistic to me. The thing I share with people is that the reason there are no crack houses on Ward Parkway is not because they have better police. It's because the residents of Ward Parkway won't allow them. And so this idea that we have to have these institutional entities to rebuild is just not rooted in any reality. To me, unless the community is willing to stand up and do those things that need to be done, no government, no matter how well-intentioned, no matter how broad, is going to be able to do that. But I'd like to quickly get back to that economic homesteading that one of the callers talked about. One of the things that I think is very important and vital is that we need to look at these economic impact zones. And in these economic impact zones, what we would do is we would remove the taxes and also remove the minimum wage regulations in order to allow the youth in these communities to be able to work. In other words, we've got to create economic impact zones that are going to create the business and economics that are going to rebuild these communities.
There is so much more to talk about, but unfortunately, we have reached the end of the time that we have for this conversation, so maybe we've just got to have another one someday. I want to thank all of today's guests for joining me for this important conversation. Daniel, Pete, Rodney, thanks so much for your honesty.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to be with you.
We've been speaking about Troost Avenue at the end of KCUR's extended investigation of that street with city planner Daniel Serta, Rodney Knott from Reemerge, and neighborhood activist Pete Hughes. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? All right, now it's time for our weekly Tell KCUR segment. As always, I'm joined in the studio by social media producer Allison Rollitz. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Gina.
What did we ask our listeners this week?
Well, Gina, we asked them how the state line affects their life.
Why this question?
Well, you've been hearing a lot today talk about Troost. KCUR has been doing this Beyond Our Borders project for the past few months, and it was really the result of a social media call out when we asked Kansas Cityans, what are the most divisive lines in the metro? And people came back with a bunch of lines. One of them was Troost, and one of them was State Line. And so we're not going to be ending our coverage of Troost, but as we kind of move on to this next reporting, I guess, area, we're going to be focusing on State Line. So we really wanted to help ask the listeners to help inform our reporting as we move forward.
What did we hear back about State Line?
Well, the biggest answer was a lot on taxes, actually. On Twitter, Marge sums up the feelings of a lot of people when she says, quote, having to file taxes in two states is by far the biggest drawback to the state line for me. And then Chantilly tweeted that she actually won't work in Kansas because she hates having to file two state income tax forms.
Even if she got her dream job in Kansas.
Well, I don't know. We can tweet her back. But apparently the filing two forms is a real big pain for her. And a lot of people brought up the inconvenience of when you're married, filing jointly in Missouri is different than Kansas, and just a lot of the tax headaches. But we did have a little back and forth on this. For instance, we have had a little counter argument from Sarah, who tweeted that taxes really aren't that big of a deal for her. She said, I'm significantly less likely to accept a job across the border just for the sole issue of taxes. So there are people out there that don't think it's that big of a deal.
What else did people say?
Well, a lot of things, and I'm really happy that we heard from people. Gas prices, you know, people, you know, at one time or another, Missouri will be cheaper or more expensive than Kansas and vice versa. Several people brought up education. For instance, Ashley tweeted, I live in JoCo for the schools, but wish I could live in Kansas City as I am in the arts. So we had that kind of tug and pull with education and school district quality. We got one comment on the effect on nonprofits, which is actually kind of interesting.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if we were expecting that. Yeah. Kyle, he tweeted us that basically the state line doesn't affect him at all personally, but quote, the nonprofit I work for only serves Missouri, so that presents challenges. And so I guess, you know, for nonprofits or lots of organizations, if you're the Kansas Association of da-da-da-da and you can only help Kansans, it might be hard when Missourians are knocking on your door asking for help, too. And then licenses was another thing. Like we had a realtor talking about him lamenting about having to get two licenses for the metro area. And I guess anyone, like a hairdresser or anyone that had to get license. They'd have to go through the same thing.
Wow. Well, what about the border war? People love to talk about that. Did it come up in this conversation?
Yeah, people, politicians, like we actually did some, you know, kind of reporting of our own, and we talked to stakeholders. And a lot of them told us that, you know, the economic incentives, kind of that battle going on of pulling businesses from one side of the state line to the other, that that's a huge issue for them. But we only got one tweet about that out of all of our reaction. That came from Matt. I'm going to read his reaction on that. He said, the state line defines an economic incentives war that's holding back a city we want to grow to something better. And so that was really the only thing we heard.
So when you say stakeholders, what kind of, who are we talking about without naming names necessarily?
We called up some politicians. We called up some people that are active in the business community, just some people that are really involved in neighborhood associations. It seems to be a big thing at the top of minds of kind of officials and people kind of dealing with the business community.
Community leaders.
Yeah, sure. But I guess just regular people, when you think about the state line, I guess you think about taxes.
Well, so did people keep it clean in this conversation? Or did some of that rivalry get in the way of that?
I would say mostly we had a very intelligent conversation online. But as this went through, like, so we started our promotion on Monday and we're ending it today. It got a little dirtier, I guess, as it went through. For instance, on Facebook, Tom said the state line makes for great driving jokes. And that's really what people honed in on.
What does that mean?
Well, maybe this call will help out. Kevin called us in and he said bad driving impacts both sides of the state line.
I'd say that the main thing about the state line that affects my life, on the Kansas side, they think that we're bad drivers because when we go over to Kansas, we're trying out all their weird little intersections. We're going through some crazy roundabouts. The roads really don't make much sense. The numbering system's all weird. They've named some of the roads the same things that we have. Generally, it just gets pretty crazy, and we may come off like bad drivers just because we cannot navigate their weird and stupid roads. Now, on the Missouri side, when Kansans come over to Missouri, we think that they're bad drivers because they actually are.
Okay, so that is a caller with a point of view.
So there you go. We had a lot of people calling folks on the other side of the state line bad drivers is really just the bottom line.
Well, Allison, this has been great. I love knowing what our listeners think, and it's been great having you here as always.
Thank you so much, Tina.
And that wraps up our Tell KCUR conversation. That's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much to everyone who participated in the conversation. To listen back to today's show or any previous discussions on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. Tomorrow, Charles Ferruzza and the Food Critics will help you find delicious tacos in Kansas City. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with lots of help from interns Christina Leffring and Matt Hodapp. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date.